Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
We are back for another edition of the MMA Report podcast. I am Jason Floyd. He is Deo Galvan, and we are here to talk about everything going on in the world of mixed martial arts. We'll talk about some of the key storylines coming out of UFC 256. What an unbelievable fight card last Saturday night. If you were like myself and forked over the $73 it is for me after taxes, you were happy with what you saw last Saturday night. So we'll talk about various things, you know, kind of talk about fight of the year, fight of the year, because obviously that played into a couple of the situations from Saturday night. Also, we will talk about Yoel Romero is now a Bellator fighter as he signed with the promotion earlier this week. We'll get you ready for UFC Vegas number 17, which is coming up on Saturday night, an unbelievable fight card on ESPN Plus. And also, we'll talk about the UFC COVID protocols in Las Vegas, as clearly the UFC has woken up and realized they had a problem with their protocols. Daniel, it is early here on Wednesday morning, December 16th. I know a little early for you there in the Rio Grande. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Jason. I mean, you know, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling positive and optimistic. I mean, just this week, we had coronavirus vaccine delivered to my area. I'm sure there were some delivered in your area. And I think quite often this past year, it's been a real rough year. We've had so much news, so much negativity with the pandemic affecting our lives. And I think it's kind of cool. We could start this podcast finally, months into this great nightmare, saying, hey, there's literally a vaccine on the ground. So there are people getting vaccinated. So I'm feeling good, Jason. And not only that we have that going on in our lives, but damn, that was a great, great UFC card this past Saturday. I thoroughly enjoyed the pay-per-view. We had a fight of the year. We had so many promising fighters. And not only that, we don't have to wait. We got another banger of a fight card this week.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I wasn't super excited for UFC 256, but, you know, I popped down my credit card. Man, it was an unbelievable fight card. It was a great fight card, and I really enjoyed what I saw on Saturday night. I mean, obviously, the main event, unbelievable, between Davison Figueiredo and Bram Moreno. I think one of the storylines that really hasn't been discussed in terms of what we saw on Saturday night is, I think when you talk about the potential flaws people saw in Davison Figueiredo was, well, what if this fight hits the championship rounds? Will his cardio be there? Well, his cardio was there, and he goes out there and you know, it to me, it's 3-2 Figueiredo, obviously with a point deduction, you know, a draw. And I like the point deduction by Jason Herzog. I think it was warranted. I do think going forward, though, because I was thinking about this, Daniel, if you're a fighter and you get, you know, there's a little kick to the balls and, you know, you go down, do you start coughing maybe to see if you can get a point taken from your opponent?
Yeah, maybe if Jason Herzog's the referee. Like, that played a major role. And I mean, obviously, if that point deduction didn't happen, we're not talking about a majority draw. We're talking about a decision win for Davison. But I kind of like Jason Herzog taking away a point. I just feel like people are way too conservative when it comes to not deducting points due to illegal strikes. So you combine the fact that there was an illegal strike earlier in the fight, not a groin strike, with the sheer damage where he was selling it like he wasn't selling it like it didn't hurt. If it hurts, Brandon Moreno is being authentic, and he was, and I saw it, and you could just tell it played a major role. I mean, that whole round he clearly lost. I think a big reason why is because he had his gonads kicking to his upper body. He was able to recover in that fourth round, but certainly I think you can get rewarded, and I think especially the reaction from the community has been that the point deduction was fine. I mean, it was something that got the seal of approval from Big John McCarthy, and I think as an official, you can sleep well at night knowing Big John didn't disapprove of what Jason Herzog did there.
Yeah, no, I did see that. I mean, and I thought it was a great move there by Jason Herzog. You know, obviously there's a, you know, I think we definitely have a lot of recency bias when we think about, especially fight of the year. But I mean, look, to me, there's two candidates, and I don't think you can go wrong either way. If you say it's Davison Figueiredo versus Brandon Moreno, got no problem. But if you say it's Wiley Zhang and Joanna Jędrzejczyk, but from March, got no problem. There's no wrong answer there.
Yeah, there is no wrong answer, but I'll give you my answer, and I think it's Zhang and Joanna. That's my fight of the year. I loved this main event, and it's literally right up there with the best fights we've seen. It was a phenomenal fight, one of the best fights in flyweight history. I'm pretty sure it's the best fight in flyweight history. I may have recency bias there. It was unbelievable. I still think Zhang and Joanna was the best fight of the year, Jason. It was a little bit more. There were more moments in that fight when I just had my heads on my hand thinking, what the hell is happening here? This one had those moments, especially round four. That was a dope round, right? Like, it kind of felt like Davison was in control throughout this whole fight. But that round four was when the tide flipped. And when you discuss the conditioning cardio of Davison, it really came out in round five when he was able to recover. And when you take into account the fact that he was hospitalized for a stomach infection just before this fight, it's unbelievable what Figueiredo did against Brandon Moreno. So, I mean, this was it was in contention. My pick is still Joanna Zhang. But in 2021, Brandon Moreno and Davison Figueiredo are probably going to have an opportunity to go out and win fight of the year for that year.
You know, obviously the other conversation with Davison Figueiredo is whether he is the fighter of the year. And, you know, of course, there's a little bit of debate. You know, you look at Kevin Holland, what he has now done, finally has that signature win in the UFC. Oh, man, what a knockout he had there against Jacare Souza. See, personally to me, I would not vote for Kevin Holland as fighter of the year. And the reason is, it's about who he did against. Like, if I sat there and said, if you looked at Kevin Holland's UFC run this year, and I said, who is his best win outside of Jacare Souza, I don't know what people would say.
Yeah, it's tough because he did win five fights in the calendar year, but you're totally right to say that. I mean, who was it against, right? It's like the same reason why a group of five college football team doesn't make the college football playoff. And it's the same reason why you got to go above and beyond if you play for a group of five college football team to win the Heisman. I think that's just the case. At the end of the day, Kevin Holland had a historic year. He completely changed the way people perceive him, and he's slowly but surely becoming a star. And he had a star-making performance against Jacare, by the way, when he was knocking the dude out clean from his back, getting on his knee and putting him away. But when it comes to fighter of the year, I'm thinking about a championship level fighter. I value more a championship fight than winning five fights in a row. I would value more three championship fights than five normal fights, even if it's a crazy rise. And I think you do have some champions in the UFC. And Bellator doesn't really have too many Fighter of the Year candidates, largely due to the inactive period. It was much larger than that of the UFC. But even though it was a majority draw to end the year, I think Davison Figueiredo, who went 3-0-1 in the calendar year, deserves it. I mean, the performances against Joseph Benavidez alone were amazing. He had a sick win over Alex Perez. And against Brandon Moreno, I scored the fight for Figueiredo, even with the point deduction. I thought he won all the rounds except for round four. So even though he had a draw, I think for the first time in history, we're actually having a guy with a blemish on his record winning fight of the year. Usually this is an award that goes to a guy who's undefeated throughout, but Davison is still my pick.
Yeah, I mean, Davison would be my pick just mainly because of everything you just mentioned there. Now, I put it on social media, I think right after the fight, and someone brought up a really interesting name. And, you know, look, sometimes I'm not the greatest at these fighter of the year, you know, all these year-end awards. You know, I'm not the greatest because sometimes I just kind of forget about what happened earlier in the year. And someone brought the point that said, how about Jan Blachowicz? And so I was like, wow, I hadn't thought of that. And so, you know, pull up his Wikipedia page, And you forget that along with defeating Dominic Reyes by TKO back in September at UFC 253, he also knocked out Corey Anderson in the first round back in February. So to me, if I was going to rank it, it would be one Figueiredo, two Jan Blachowicz, three Kevin Holland.
Yeah, I mean, that's, he's one of the, Jan is one of the few, when you look at those top five fighters in each weight class, very few of them are undefeated and have multiple fights this calendar year. So, I mean, Jan certainly has a nice case, and he's become, you know, the top dog in the Bellator, I mean, in the Bellator, in the UFC light heavyweight division. So I definitely understand why you would go with Jan. I think Jan, because we're only talking about two fights and only one of them is for the championship, he's certainly behind Davison. But that's certainly a great pick. And I think when you think of this year, there really weren't a whole lot of like dynamite performances that were just next level. I think you had some great individual performances, but some of your all-time great fighters only performed once or twice a year. I mean, you know, if a guy like Justin Gaethje would have gone out and beaten Khabib Nurmagomedov, no matter what transpired this past weekend, I mean, Davison could have came out, delivered a baby, and turned into a tiger. He probably still wouldn't have beat Justin Gaethje. Gaethje went out there and beat Ferguson and beat Nurmagomedov. But like a guy and Khabib Nurmagomedov, who is pound for pound the best fighter on the planet right now, retired or not, probably would have won this award if he had more than one title defense in the given year.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about Khabib Nurmagomedov, and you know, I think we can officially say now the door is officially closed on Khabib and Tony Ferguson. And I think after what we saw on Saturday night, I think we now pretty have a good idea of how Khabib versus Ferguson would have gone. I mean, just complete domination by Charles Oliveira, you know, and obviously now Charles, you know, has to kind of sit back and kind of wait to see how things play out over the next, you know, 40 days or so. Of course, clearly he's got to wait to see, you know, what happens with Conor McGregor and Dustin Poirier, which will be on January 23rd. I think all signs will point to if the UFC can get a fight commitment from Khabib Nurmagomedov, and it seems pretty clear the UFC believes that Khabib is not retired, that if Dustin Poirier beats Conor McGregor, does a Charles Oliveira fight intrigue Khabib?
Well, I think a stereotypical mixed martial artist fighter, it would not intrigue you. If you were contemplating retirement, what's going to get the average dude out of retirement is the money fight. Charles Oliveira, unfortunately, is not the money fight, which is the saddest thing in the world, because Charles Oliveira is becoming, you know, that role where you had the fighter who clearly deserves a title fight. He's won 27 fights in a row and he just hasn't gotten it because it just doesn't make sense because there's other options. That's the role Oliveira possesses, but Nurmagomedov has a very different perspective on life and the sport than your average person. And I wouldn't be surprised if he takes the fight, because I think he really, really, really prioritizes the sporting aspect of mixed martial arts. I think he's content with the amount of money he has in his bank account, and he knows he's going to add a lot if he fights a broomstick. And I think he likes the idea of continuing to increase that record, and he likes the idea of doing it against the quote-unquote best challenger. So the Oliveira fight isn't the sexiest thing that gets you out of bed, but this dude deserves a title fight. I mean, what more can he do, especially the way he capped off a performance to go out there and on all three scorecards to get a 30-26 against Tony Ferguson, give him the damn title shot. And I thought you made a great point when you first started it, Jason, in saying that this fight really was interesting because it kind of showed us what would have happened under Magomedov, in that Ferguson would have spent a lot of time on his back, which is what he did against Oliveira.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the crazy fact is now that Tony Ferguson has lost 8 consecutive rounds. And this was a guy that was, you know, seen as a number 2 lightweight in the world for a very long time, you know, and this is a fighter who now turns 37 in February. You know, I mean, look, you know, I always say Father Time is undefeated. I don't know if Father Time has caught up to Tony Ferguson. I wonder how much of it is correlated to, you know, the beating he took against Justin Gaethje. It's also kind of a little bit of a red flag when you sit there and you hear Tony Ferguson not have his, you know, his head coaches and, you know, in his corner and, you know, talking about, I was listening to the Anik and Florian podcast and John Anik was, you know, talking about the fighter meeting that they had with Tony Ferguson. Apparently, Tony Ferguson, not the biggest John Anik fan at this point, but, you know, basically it was they were like, hey, man, why do you not have a coaches in your corner? And he's like, my sparring partners are my coaches. And I'm like, man, that's a red flag there and really makes you wonder what's going on inside the training of Tony Ferguson at this point.
Yeah, for Tony Ferguson, when he first started his UFC career, he was this quirky guy who did his own rehab and marched to the beat of your own drum. But the difference between something like that being quirky and cool and unique and being stupid is performing in the cage. You start performing poorly in the cage, we start to think you're crazy and you're making mistakes. You go from being the nightmare of all of the top UFC lightweights with your interesting out-of-the-cage habits from being present-day Diego Sanchez with Josh Fabia chasing you with a knife. And that's the point Tony's in. And I think more so than not, if you don't have a coach, you will not perform well. And I think for the longest time, when you look at what Tony did outside of the cage, it wasn't the correct process. He just had so much raw talent, so much skill and focus, and he's such a talented individual, both mentally and physically. He was able to get away with that. But as things start to deteriorate, I think that deterioration may be accelerated because he doesn't have the infrastructure around him to help him adjust and perform better. And I think it becomes more apparent as their career winds down, whenever that stuff isn't in place.
I don't know what to make of Tony Ferguson at this point. We're going to kind of see what 2021 looks for him. I mean, look, he's clearly still going to get, you know, a top 10 fight, but, you know, there is part of wonder, you know, are the best days of Tony Ferguson behind him? Now, of course, so we had a lot of great performances, Daniel, at UFC 256. And I want to phrase this question to you. Which UFC 256 winner has the highest ceiling? And just to kind of throw some names out there, Kevin Holland, Surreal Gunn, Rafael Fiziev, Gavin Tucker, Mackenzie Dern, Charles Oliveira. Like, and when I'm talking about highest ceiling, I'm talking like could either challenge for a UFC title or win the UFC title. I mean, I guess Charles Oliveira would be the easy answer because he's right there. But I might go Surreal Gunn.
Look, Jason, there are so many damn good performances at UFC 256. You couldn't go wrong with any of them. Surreal Gunn's not my pick, but why is he yours?
I think it's, you look at the heavyweight division, he's only 30 years old, Daniel. That's pretty young in the heavyweight division. And, you know, I mean, look, he's going to get a top five type fight in his next matchup. Now, look, does he have the tools to beat a Francis Ngannou? I don't know. Does he have the tools to beat a Curtis Blaydes? I don't know. But there are some things you see there, I mean, that I go, man, this guy, I mean, he's still a developing MMA fighter. I mean, I think that's the thing we kind of forget.
Yeah, and it's a huge win to say you knocked out Junior Dos Santos. I mean, the leg kicks he possessed in that fight were awesome. And the finish itself, I mean, that probably was an illegal strike. I thought the elbow to the back of the head. But it was one of those things where JDS was rocked. It was a moment where I'm glad he got the win and we didn't have a Matt Hamill, John Jones situation. Because Surreal Gunn was clearly winning that fight. But I do think that was probably an illegal strike in that the head was turned at just the wrong moment. And he got put away. I think, again, there are so many great fighters. I mean, a guy you didn't even mention who wouldn't make my pick, and I'll tell you my pick in a moment, but Rafael Fiziev against Renato Makano, holy crap, his striking was crazy. Like this guy has crazy upside, too, as a striker and as a grappler. Chase Hooper does against Peter Barrett, but obviously, I mean, Joe Rogan, through that fight, was ready to outcast him to learn how to strike because of how poor it looked. But the Imanari rolls were delightful. But to answer your question, to come full circle, I really want to pick Kevin Holland. He was awesome, but my pick is Mackenzie Dern, man. I mean, she went up against Verna Jandaroba, and both these fighters are really good grapplers. Mackenzie, though, showcased real improvement in her stand-up, and if that striking continues to improve at that rate, I think Mackenzie Dern has a real, real chance to be a perennial fixture challenging for the Women's Strawweight Championship. I think it's going to be quite difficult to gain it, but I think what she's shown is she can improve greatly in areas that she's weak at, and she's already an incredibly strong grappler. She's going to get the UFC behind them. I think if you look at this entire roster, which one fighter is the UFC going to put the most marbles behind? And I think Mackenzie's the answer. That's the fighter that's going to get them behind her the most.
No, I would agree with that. I would absolutely agree with that. Mackenzie Dern would be the one. By the way, Jason Perillo had the line of the night when she comes back. Well, what was that? Her first round, maybe second round. I think it was second round. And she's like, "Is my nose broke?" He goes, no, your nose is fine. And immediately changes the subject. I'm like, I was on my couch just laughing my ass off.
Yeah, that was a great moment. I really enjoy him as a coach, and I think that look, there's no reason why you need to be addressing the elephant in the room until after the fight's over. You don't want to throw them off. You just got to tell them not to blow their nose, or else they're gonna be in real trouble. I thought that was great, but I mean, we could have easily have also said Kevin Holland is our pick, right? I mean, look at the way this guy has changed. And I think the reason why I didn't pick Kevin is he's not outright dominating some of these fights. I mean, he's dominating most of them. But on this one, he was in a precarious position when he's on his back. And then he lands a strike. So, like, he just has incredible, incredible, like, I guess, instincts or, like, raw power. Because he's getting finishes that I've never seen before. I think in a different era. In the early 2010s, I think Kevin Holland is a lot more famous than he is now. And I think he's probably more emblematic of the problem the UFC has, because, you know, there are some days where I feel like the UFC doesn't have any stars, and they don't have too many. But as a hardcore fan, when you watch this entire fight card, literally every single fight was either entertaining or had stakes. Which is like, this was a damn good fight card. It's just the UFC's having trouble communicating to people how talented these fighters are. And I think Kevin's one of those examples that I think in a different era, he would be a much bigger name based on what he did in this year. But certainly, he's another one of those fighters with the upside where you can certainly see him challenging for a middleweight championship.
Yeah, one thing I want to mention about Chase Hooper, Joe Rogan's not wrong. I mean, this is like, if I was in the Chase Hooper camp, I would probably say, let's take 6 months off and let's just work on your striking, because, you know, as they always say, the last thing you want to be is a fighter developing in the UFC. And, you know, if the UFC wants to continue to be in the business of, you know, Chase Hooper, what he potentially can be, like, you have to be very selective in who you match him up against, because I mean, there's just so much deficiencies you see in his stand-up game. Like, I mean, I know, you know, Rogan and DC were harsh on him, but they weren't wrong.
Yeah, he looked really bad. There's a hardcore deficiency, and I think without a doubt you're right in suggesting that it's time to take some time off and develop. You know, he's so young, and it's just like, you have time to be patient. You have time, and you're in a great position, and you don't want to be the guy who gets knocked out three times in a row and he's outside the UFC. I think that really hurts your reputation, your perception, and you're going to have opportunities to rebound. But while you're currently in the UFC, I think Chase Hooper's camp would do him well in trying your best to mitigate that, navigate that, and make sure that doesn't happen, and correct the striking while you're in the UFC. So it's incredibly hard to develop. But I think the combination of Chase taking time off to train, as well as when he does pick his next few fights, that the matchups themselves aren't tremendous challenges, that they aren't massive steps up. Because his stand-up in striking looked worse than below average. I mean, they looked not UFC level.
No, I mean, I think it's also this problem, and you see it with Dana White's Contender Series, where there are fighters that I'm like, why are you... I understand the financial aspect of why you take that fight, especially in today's regional world where, you know, I mean, look, there's not many shows going on. But it's also like, you know, if you win that fight, your next fight could be in the UFC. Is your fighter ready? And you look at Chase Hooper, and this guy's just... You know, you're not need to be developing in the UFC. And look, it's, you know, clearly, and you mentioned about it, he is slick on the ground. There is no doubt about it, but he's got to get it there. And when he can't get it there, he is in trouble. You know, I thought Peter Barrett, I felt he fought a little tentative in terms of the striking aspect, where you could just tell that he was concerned about what if this fight hit the ground, and probably Peter Barrett's days are over. Wouldn't be in the UFC. Wouldn't be surprised Jacare Souza's days in the UFC are over. Wouldn't be surprised if JDS's days in the UFC are over. But overall, great fight card. UFC 256. We'll talk about this Saturday's UFC Vegas card. Great fight card. Of course, I already lost one fight as we do this show. Bilal Muhammad announced on his social media that he has tested positive for COVID-19. His fight against against Diego Lima is off the card. Diego Lima saying the fight is going to be rescheduled for another date. So right now, as we do the show, we're at 14 fights. We'll see if we get to 14 fights come Saturday night. But Daniel, the big news really this week after UFC 256 is the fact that Bellator has signed Yoel Romero. Initially, they passed on Yoel Romero. I wonder how much of that is more based on maybe the number that was thrown to them just was not a number they were comfortable with, and negotiations happened. And I did see Yoel Romero's manager, Malky Kawa, noted after the signing that he's going to be starting a podcast, and that he's going to tell the entire story of how this whole Yoel Romero situation came about, which will be a very interesting story to hear. But, man, this is, you know, I'm a little surprised Bellator did go this route. I mean, we talked about it a lot last week of, you know, I think the question with Yoel Romero is, it's not what Yoel Romero is to Bellator in 2021. What's Yoel Romero look like in 2022? You know, what is the long-term value here for Yoel Romero and Bellator? But, you know, I talked about this on my Sunday podcast, and I mean, it was just me just kind of talking, no inside information. I just said, and this is obviously before Yoel officially signed with Bellator, I said, I just had a gut feeling that your next Bellator light heavyweight next tournament will be a light heavyweight tournament. It will not be women's 125 pounds because, I mean, look, at the end of the day, if you're Scott Coker and you want to put on a tournament, you want to put on a tournament that's going to get the MMA fan base excited. You want to put on a tournament that's going to bring more eyeballs to the Bellator product. And I tweeted about it on earlier this week, and I said, if you talked about a Bellator 8-man tournament, and I'm going to throw you the names out here, Daniel, and tell me this is a not hashtag would watch for you. So you'd have Vadim Nemkov, the champion, Ryan Bader, the former champion, Phil Davis, Rumble Johnson, Yoel Romero, Corey Anderson, Leo Machida, and my number 8 guy I threw in there was Gegard Mousasi. Daniel, sorry, that is hashtag would watch.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is would watch. There really isn't a weak part of that entire tournament. I mean, the weak part is going to be whenever somebody pulls out of that tournament, because I think out of any weight class, light heavyweight is the one where you're probably the most concerned about somebody pulling out. But dude, like, it's just like Bellator was patient for the announcing the next tournament, and it kind of just fell in their own hands. I think with the UL signing, combined with the Anthony Johnson signing, I think everyone is doing the same math, and they're like, damn, there are 8 legitimate fighters you can put in this tournament, and it's Wood Watch. And that's what they need to do, because they're spending a lot of money on these contracts. That's an expensive tournament. But if you spend a lot of money on those contracts and you just do these stereotypical Bellator cards where you have a 1-fight main event and 3 fights that are really good but aren't resonating with casual fans, you're kind of wasting your money because the viewership isn't going to be there. But if you're able to dress up these light heavyweights in the tournament makeup and really create some buzz and momentum similar to the Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix, and the buzz momentum won't be at that level. I mean, that was unique, and you had fighters like Fedor in it with so many other great heavyweights. I think that's just a no-brainer. I mean, Scott Coker loves tournaments. I mean, I feel like just around the house, he probably does tournaments, you know, like just if he wants to pick a dog, he just does a tournament of dogs and he just picks one. I mean, I just think this man loves himself tournaments. I think he was the type of guy who, passing time in high school, would create imaginary brackets of random things and figure out a winner. So, I mean, that's Scott's bread and butter. And I think the light heavyweight tournament is definitely a no-brainer. I think the only questions is financially, does it make sense? And we're also talking about some old geezers in that light heavyweight weight class. And the question would be, would they be up for fighting this many times? And I mean, that's an interesting question to ask a guy like Yoel, who I think probably would be down, but I would be more interested in the answer coming from a guy like Anthony Johnson.
I think it's an interesting debate when we're talking about who has the best light heavyweight division as we currently stand here in December of 2020. I know how much you love when Scott Coker tells you how much he has the best light heavyweight division, the best bantamweight division in the world, but I put this tweet out there and I'll get your take on it. Because I do think it's an interesting debate on who has the best light heavyweight division. Look, if we're talking as a depth, it's no question it's the UFC. They have much, much better depth than Bellator. But if you matched up the top five UFC light heavyweights versus the top five Bellator light heavyweights, so the UFC, you would have, you know, the champion Jan Blachowicz, Glover Teixeira, Thiago Santos, Dominic Reyes, and Anthony Rakic. Bellator, Nemkov, Bader, Anderson, Rumble, and then Romero or Phil Davis, whichever one you want to take. Who wins the best out of five?
Oh, man. God, it's tough, dude. This is one of those times where, like, honest to God, Bellator might have the better weight class, which is not something I thought I would have said. I hand-wave that often. But with the addition of Romero and Johnson, those weight classes start to fill out. I think from a pure talent level standpoint, you did that. You matched those guys up. I think Vadim Nemkov would handle himself quite well. But I think the UFC fighters tend to would probably be the better fighters. I think one of the things you got to look at, though, Jason, is the particular matchups. Because when you look at some of the abilities of those Bellator fighters, I think they would match up well with some of the abilities of those top eight UFC light heavyweights.
I think the question would be is how would a Rakic match up against, you know, a wrestler like Romero or a Davis? I mean, look, I think it's, you know, I don't know how many people agree with me, but right now I think it's I would probably say I think Vadim Nemkov is the best light heavyweight in the world. It's no slight to Jan Blachowicz. It's just I think Nemkov is amazing. But you brought up this question, you know, to me, where you said, you know, for the next 2 or 3 years, as you look at both rosters, which five light heavyweights would you want to have the most? And I was thinking about it, Daniel. My first pick would probably be Anthony Rakic.
Wow. I think my first pick would be, I mean, I look at that group with Rakic and in Yuri, and I'm like, I definitely want one of those guys. But I think, even though Rakic is certainly maybe more well-rounded, I think a guy in Yuri is more exciting to have on my roster. And so I would go with Yuri over Alexander Rakic. But I think my number one pick, even though I think Jan is the best light heavyweight in the world, going forward, I would want Yuri on my roster, but Vadim Nemkov would be the guy I would run and sign first. So if we're talking about if all the light heavyweights in the world were a free agent, I'll be frank with you, I think the first one I would try and sign would be the guy who's the Bellator champion.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, look, the one downside when you look at this Bellator light heavyweight division as it currently stands, you know, all these guys are older. And the question is, you know, what does that division look like in 3 years? You know, and look, and Bellator is going to have the ability to add quality talent to their roster over the next couple of months based on whoever the UFC decides to cut. Now, part of that is, and me and you were talking about this via text message of, you know, look, you're going to have to most likely overpay for some of that talent. And I think it's about, for Bellator, it's about acquiring the right talent. Now, if your thought process was already, okay, we're going to do a 205-pound tournament and we're looking at, you know, fighters 7 and 8, we add Yoel Romero to the mix, we throw Gegard Mousasi in there, that's something that will get people talking. And, you know, and that's to me, I think it's a quality move by Scott Coker. But I think if I'm looking at the downside, is I just don't know what is the long-term value of someone like Yoel Romero. You know, I did see Malky noted that Yoel will fight at 85, 205, or heavyweight. You know, I really do wonder if you're Yoel Romero at this point in his career, you know, does he want to cut down 185 pounds? But look, we all wish we had the body of Yoel Romero at 42 years old. I mean, the guy's, you know, he's chiseled.
Mm-hmm. He looks amazing, and he's definitely grabbed the hands of time and put him in an armbar. He's changed the way we perceive fighters in their 40s aging. So I think he's going to be competitive for 2 years. But I mean, the idea of him competing at a high level in 2023 seems insane and unreal. It's possible, but it would be pretty unprecedented. There are times, and obviously Randy Couture was very successful as an aging fighter. And Yoel could be just like that, and I think it'll be a much easier time in the Bellator, you know, competing against those fighters. But I think it was the signing that really put Bellator over the edge in that weight class and made it more interesting. I think the benefit for Bellator is when you contrast the Bellator light heavyweights, the UFC light heavyweights, is Bellator benefits from taking these fighters from the UFC who the UFC has invested time in and has turned into stars, like Lyoto or even Anthony Johnson. And so now they get all that promotion, all that stuff, and now they go to Bellator and they have their name value. So when you compare guys like Bader, Davis, Nemkov, Anthony Johnson, Phil Davis, Yoel Romero, Corey Anderson, Lyoto Machida, to Jan Glover, Thiago Santos, Dominic Reyes, Rakic, Jury, Anthony Smith, and Volkan, the casual mixed martial arts fan actually knows more of the Bellator names than the UFC names, and that's the only weight class you can say that in. So that's interesting to me. The other trend that you see, though, is that Bellator has a lot of wrestlers, right? Those are the guys that the UFC doesn't make sure they hold on to. So that probably affects the fight quality, but I think when you look at both these rosters, I think Bellator, one of the other advantages they have is they just have more known commodities in this weight class.
I will say the one name in the Bellator light heavyweight division to keep an eye on, Christian Edwards, 4-0, trains out of Jackson Wink. Just, I believe he just signed a new deal with Bellator. Grant Neal's another one. You know, I think that's the thing where Bellator really, you know, has to, you know, develop that the bottom half of their roster and those fighters that are developing. But man, you know, I'm interested to see kind of what Bellator does with this light heavyweight division. I mean, look, if you said they're not doing a tournament and they come out and say, hey, we're kicking off 2021 Rumble Johnson versus Yoel Romero. All right, cool. Tell me the date because I'm in front of the television set.
Yeah, I think Rumble Johnson is the guy I'm most excited to see compete. I think he's the one with the most question marks and the most upside among the veterans. And I think if we were doing a list of like top five guys I would want in my promotion, I think I might even spend a pick on Rumble Johnson, because I just think throughout his career, he has untapped potential that we've seen moments of, but then as soon as we see that, he's gone for a while. So dude, would watch. I think that's probably the most important thing, what you mentioned there. And that is passing the baton. It's easy to put a contract that's really nice and to sign a guy. The hard part is when you have a star with diminishing returns like Lyoto or Yoel, who with each given fight gets older and performs worse, the way you ensure that you are successful is you use their star and their name power to build your next generation of stars. So whether or not these signings are successful is entirely dependent on the success of those up-and-comers that you mentioned and having them become, you know, replace Machida and Yoel as known light heavyweights.
Yeah, that's the big thing for Bellator going forward, and we'll see what happens there. But Daniel, coming up on Saturday night, we got UFC Vegas number 17, the final UFC event of the year. And man, can't wait for this one on Saturday night. Top to bottom, a great fight card the UFC has put together. I mentioned a little earlier, we've already lost one fight on this card. We'll see if we continue with 14 fights or whether we see more changes. Of course, initially, this was supposed to be Khamzat Chimaev versus Leon Edwards, but we all know that fight got moved a couple weeks ago due to Leon Edwards testing positive for COVID. I believe it's expected to take place, I want to say, January 20th on Fight Island. But overall, man, this fight card is unbelievable. I look at just the fights. Obviously, the main event of Stephen Thompson versus Jeff Neal, really interesting to kind of see. Obviously, a huge step up in competition for Jeff Neal based on who he's been fighting. And of course, Stephen Thompson, he wants to get back, obviously, back into that title contention. Jose Aldo, Marlon Vera. He's your co-main event. Michelle Paheya versus Chaos Williams. Who's not excited to see that chaos? Because that will be chaos between those two guys. I mean, we've seen what Chaos Williams does, and we've seen that capoeira style from Michelle Paheya. That is a fight that really does intrigue me. A noble matchup at women's flyweight between Jillian Robertson and Thiago Santos. Greg Hardy's taking on Marcin Tybura. Kind of interesting that Greg Hardy is the favorite in that one. You got Anthony Pettis taking on Alex Morono, and a couple other fights. Cody Durden, who was supposed to fight a couple weeks ago against Jimmy Flick, that fight is happening here. It didn't happen the first time because Cody got pink eye during fight week. But, man, Daniel, overall, top to bottom, of course, this whole fight card will be on ESPN+. Prelim start scheduled to start at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Main card 7 p.m. Eastern time. It's just a great way to end the year for the UFC.
Yeah, it's shocking that this is the only fight card we got left in the year. But I mean, the year is winding down. I'm excited, man. I mean, this main card is dope. It really is dope. I mean, every fight's interesting. Every fight is going to be exciting. And I think when this fight night was designed, you could see clearly the intention was on this main card to put together possible fight of the nights. I mean, this along with the unfortunately departed Chimaev Edwards fight, pretty much every main card fight features one or two guys who have reputations of being incredibly entertaining. I think you can't go wrong if you tune into ESPN+. I think the only downside is that this fight card isn't on ESPN. This seems like the perfect fight card to put on ESPN. You know, for a casual fan to turn on the television and to flip on to Marlon Moraes versus Rob Font or Aldo versus Vera or Chaos versus Pereira, I mean, that's just the type of way you can generate new fans. But, I mean, overall, I'm so excited. And I think when you get a guy like Anthony Pettis, who's just kind of hit it on this card, a guy who a lot of people have strong feelings about and is a veteran in the name, I think that's a testament. When you have guys like him and Aldo who have prominent parts on this card but aren't the featured attraction, it shows you that this is one of those rare occasions where we have a UFC fight night card that has depth. But to go along with the depth, we just have plain old good fights.
Yeah, I mean, as I was thinking about here of ranking my top five fights, I have five fights that, I know the five fights that are in my top five, but I could literally go anywhere in terms of how I rank them one through five. Number one for me is the main event, Stephen Thompson versus Jeff Neal. Number two for me, I don't know how much this would be number two for anyone else. Rob Font, Marlon Moraes, I think, is my number two fight. Really interested to see what does Rob Font look like. First fight since ACL surgery at the beginning of the year. If I got to go number three, I would go Aldo versus Chito Vera. I don't know. I think this is a great opportunity for Chito Vera fighting Jose Aldo at the right time. Number four, I would go give me Chaos Williams and Michelle Paheya. As I mentioned, that's going to be chaos between those two guys. And then number five, I would go Jillian Robertson versus Thalia Santos.
Oh, that's a good one. We have very similar lists. Our number five is different. Our one and two are different. I have Font and Moraes at one, and then I have Thompson Neal at two. I have Aldo Vera at three. We're in simpatico with that one, and I think Pereira Chaos, it's hard not to put that one in your top five, and that's my number four, just like you. I just think both those guys are absolutely insane in the best way possible. For number five, I'm going to go Anthony Pettis, Alex Moreno. I'm just a major fan of Anthony Pettis. And even though he's aged and there are ups and downs, I still want this welterweight bout in my top five. But what sticks out to you about the Robertson-Santos matchups?
It's a key matchup at 125 pounds. Interesting to see if that fight hits the floor. We've seen what Julian Robertson can do. When you talk about, you know, that kind of next wave of potential contenders there at 125 pounds, I think this is a fight you have to look at in terms of these two fighters as they progress forward. And obviously this was, both of them have been, subsequently their opponents and, there was COVID issues and whatnot, but I just think from a divisional importance aspect, that's why it's in my top five.
Well, I think you can't go wrong, man. I mean, I think you have a list of 5 to 7 fights that you really are excited about. I mean, depending on how you feel about it, you might even throw Hardy Tybura in there. Obviously, I'm not the biggest Greg Hardy fan, but that's still an interesting fight. And I think for him, that's a fight where if he's successful, that's a real validation of he's going to hang around, because Marcin is, I guess the word would be stalwart in the heavyweight division, where if you get past him, that really, really showcases that you're going to be around for a while now. And I think it's interesting that Hardy is the favorite there, but I'm hyped, man. I mean, Neil Thompson, don't sleep on that fight. I hope it's a good one. There is the possibility at times, and Steven certainly is cautious, and those fights are a little more technical, and then you can kind of put on your glasses and pretend to be the ME nerd aficionado and pretend to appreciate it, but you're looking at your phone on Twitter most of the fight. But I think Neil brings out the excitement. And I mean, that main event is something I'm excited for.
Yeah, the Hardy-Tybura, and like you, I was surprised to see that Greg Hardy is a favorite in that one. I mean, I think the question for me is more along the lines of what happens if Tybura is able to get that fight to the ground. I mean, look, you know, obviously we've seen what Greg Hardy can do, standing up and the power that he does possess in his hands. But you know, I think the question would be is, for Tybura, if he does get the fight to the ground, but also I think the other side of that is what happens if Greg Hardy can't get a finish in the first round, or, the opening part of the second round. Will that cardio be there? That's going to be a question mark there. But I mean, look, it's, we talked about obviously the away from fighting issues with Greg Hardy. And I just kind of prefer to talk about, because we kind of talked about ad nauseum about, his issues there. But I mean, look, the guy can be a problem at heavyweight with his striking, but I do wonder what happens if he gets put on his back.
I think it's not a good time, but I mean, for him, if he gets put on his back, he's just got to be able to get back up. I mean, I don't expect him to go out there and try a triangle choke, but I think when you are really good at some of those aspects and it's a bit later in your career, it's obviously important, but to become a skilled grappler. But for Greg, I mean, I think it's just a matter of getting to where you had the best chance of success. So I have a feeling he's going to be able to sprawl back up, but over time it's when the cardio comes into play when it's going to be harder to not just stick to the mat.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to kind of see how this one does play out. Looking forward to watching it on Saturday night. Of course, the other big note with the UFC this week was the fact of they have finally decided to change their protocols on COVID. Apparently, it finally just took massive multiple weeks for them to decide, hey, may we have a problem? Of course, Tisha Torres talked about this in her post-fight interview where she said, we couldn't go anywhere. It's really strict, which, by the way, should have been the protocols from day one. But Alex Scafari, who she writes for Bloody Elbow and a couple other websites, she put out there that this email that got sent out to fighters in terms that are fighting this week, and part of the one screenshot she put out there was the use of transportation during fight week, where it says, quote, to ensure the integrity of UFC's COVID-19 testing and quarantine protocols, no athlete or corner will be permitted to use any vehicle not officially approved or arranged by the UFC once the athlete or corner has checked in for fight week. This includes personally owned vehicles, rental vehicles, a friend's vehicle, or rideshare vehicles such as Uber or Lyft. This policy applies to all athletes and corners, including those based in Las Vegas, as well as those based outside of Las Vegas. In addition, any athlete or corner who leaves the hotel property without coordinating with the UFC event operations, including post-fight, will not be allowed back into the hotel. If an athlete or corner needs transportation for any reason during fight week, including to go to the market, the UFC Performance Institute, or the UFC Apex, they must call with UFC Event Operations. Thank you in advance for your cooperation. So, you know, the one thing that I've kind of said about these UFC protocols is I'm going, we don't know what they are. Because while other leagues have been transparent about what their protocols are in doing their sporting events, the UFC is typical UFC standard. They're just letting you know what they want you to know. And it just became so clear over the past couple of weeks of like, they've got issues when, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, if a fighter, you know, arrives in Las Vegas and he tests positive, but the fact of when you're seeing that fighters are testing positive on their weigh-in COVID tests, it's like, you got to look at yourself in the mirror. And it's just amazing. It took this long for the UFC to look at themselves in the mirror and go, maybe it's our protocols.
Yeah. I mean, there was a real result of something was wrong here with the amount of fights that were being pulled after fighters tested negative, after cornermen tested negative to start the week. Whenever you had that many fights being called off that late into fight week, there's a legitimate problem there. And it's shocking and surprising. I mean, it makes sense in life. You do have lapses of concentration and focus, but that usually happens with an individual. When you have a system of several people working together in a big business, those lapses don't really happen because you have checks and balances. You have pressure that you don't want to let go of the rope because someone else is going to notice and they're going to, you know, it's a dog eat dog world in a lot of workplace environments. So usually in a system like this, you don't see the lapses, but you certainly saw that. And the proof was in the pudding, you know, as one would say. The results were there with the amount of positive fights getting called off late into fight week. So it's a bit shocking that it would happen there. It makes some of the language with how well they're handling this pandemic fall a bit flat. But it's certainly nice that they made that adjustment. And the great thing is that, you know, we're in the final part of this marathon. You know, God willing, knock on wood, that we don't have COVID-20 coming out of nowhere, right? With a steel chair, you know, with the lights go out and it's a pro wrestling entrance and it's COVID-20. No, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope we're done with this bullshit in about April, man. I mean, I think, you know, this has been one of the most traumatic times in modern history for an American and for people across the world. So I can't wait to get over this. But the last thing I'll say is that it's not that damn hard to fly to Las Vegas and just chill in the damn bubble. You're only doing it for a week. You're only doing it for 2 weeks. You're doing this is your business. You're doing it for a paycheck. Take care of business. You know, you can go to the strip club and eat their chicken wings after you win.
By the way, did you see who Bellator signed yesterday?
I don't know who you're talking about. No, who did they sign?
You remember the viral video of the woman having the fight in Russia against a 530-pound dude?
Yeah, I did. I do remember that.
They have signed her.
Ah, damn it! I was hoping they signed the 500-pound dude. Damn it, dude! That's awesome that they did that.
Oh, the perfect. Also, so you know, I'm 39 years old. You're much younger than I am. So I need your expertise on something.
What's that?
What is the fascination with the Paul brothers and MMA websites?
Well, you don't have to be 39 years old to know the fascination with it. It's the clicks, brother. I mean, you know, Jake Paul, Logan Paul. I mean, they are the new version. I mean, they get you clicks. You put Logan Paul, you put Jake Paul in the article. You put Logan Paul, you put Jake Paul in the tweet. It's going to get attention. These people, their whole business is attention. It's not fighting. And if you're an MMA website and you're like, damn, my clicks are low. Let's get some active users on our website. Let's do another Jake Paul versus Conor McGregor article. That's the answer. I don't know why Jake and Logan are so big in popular culture. I'm not a fan of their work. They have some controversies in their past. I mean, I think one of them literally recorded a vlog in a suicide forest. I think that was Logan Paul, which that was insane. But I don't know, Jason, but I do know. And the answer is money. Follow the bag. And the bag is we're going to get some clicks if we put Jake Paul in our headline.
Dude, I was like going through my Twitter timeline yesterday. And like, and no matter what time of the day I went on, it was like 6-7 tweets, I'm just like, I'm over it. I get what it is. I get that it brings clicks, and I get that. I mean, look, both these guys do train in boxing, and look, I understand. This is a payday to them. They're looking for massive paydays, but then, like, I'm sitting there, I see that video of, well, I think it was Jake Paul, as he's in the back of a truck with a film crew throwing water balloons at Dylan Danis, and I'm like, I don't know, Daniel, like, to me, it's like you're starving for attention and you'll do anything to get people talking about you.
Yeah, I know. But unfortunately, it works, man. It works. It's like, it's annoying, especially as someone who's older, right? Like, if you're not 14 years old, a lot of this stuff is just annoying and it doesn't work with you. But it works. I mean, they're making money and then they got attention. And, you know, you listen to a podcast, you listen to some of the biggest sports podcasts in the world, like Pardon My Take, right? They consistently mention him in their podcasts. And you know, you listen to the Bill Simmons podcast, one of the most popular sports podcasts too. He mentions Jake Paul whenever he fought. He did that last fight. And just occasionally in passing when talking about his son. So, I mean, he is a part of culture.
It's crazy.
More so than most mixed martial arts fighters, right? Like, it's annoying, though. I mean, I've been following the Paul brothers because, you know, I partake in some of the YouTube video watching, and they've been around for a while. I mean, Logan Paul's been around since Vine. I'm pretty sure Vine is how Logan Paul started. But that type of content is what I don't like.
I thought they were YouTubers. Am I wrong with that?
Well, I'm pretty sure they did Vine and then they transitioned to YouTube, like a lot of people did. He could have started off as YouTube, and maybe he wasn't. Yeah, it says Paul rose to fame as a member on the internet sharing Vine, but I think he had a YouTube account before, but it was on Vine where he got popular. Logan Paul got popular on Vine, and then Jake kind of like got popular after Logan. But it was through Vine. Vine made a couple stars, Logan was one of them.
One thing I will kind of end on this note is because I had put a tweet out about this. Just like, I'm just tired of seeing this. And Derek Scott, regional fighters, appeared on Titan Games, season one of the Titan Games. He responded to me with this. He said, "Recognize that for those not in the combat sports community, the Paul brothers are their prism through which they see fighting and combat sports. I think we, martial arts and hardcores, should think about that and be aware of how we welcome outsiders or casual fans." I just responded, I go, "No doubt, both of them bringing you audience." And Derek responded to that saying, "Unique and increased eyeballs on combat sports athletes are an opportunity. I think we should all seek out and explore as many opportunities as possible. I love it. It also reinforces, if you're not a fighter, do not fight. A la Nate Robinson."
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. I mean, at the end of the day, Paul put in the work. And when you don't, you end up like Robinson. I think one other random thought I had was, these types of fights do not live up in terms of legacy. Because I feel like we see these types of fights all the time. But when we think back to the history of boxing, the only quote-unquote freak fight I can remember is Antonio Inoki versus Muhammad Ali. And that wasn't even a fight. That was a fake wrestling match. I wonder what is the comparison to a similar fight in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s in boxing that is similar to a Jake Paul versus Floyd Mayweather fight, or Jake Paul versus Nate Robinson. I wonder if there were those types of fights that got real popularity back in the day that just we don't talk about today.
I wonder, kind of to on that point, if you walked into a boxing gym today and you talked to, you know, a pro boxer who's put up a great record, I wonder what their view of the Paul brothers are and the amount of money they're potentially making in boxing as compared to other notable boxers.
Oh, I'm sure they'd be frustrated. I'm sure they'd also want to get a piece of that pie.
Oh, I'm sure they're probably like, "Sign me up for that fight. I'll beat the crap out of that dude." I mean, look, and one of the things and Malky Caldwell brought this up, that they talked to Jake Paul's management about having a boxing matchup against Yoel Romero. Cold feet. No answer.
Yeah, I can't. That's understandable. You imagine going up against Jordan Merrill, you're going to end up on the mat just like Nate Robinson.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's kind of just interesting to see what combat sports has turned into. And I think that, you know, look, we are going to see much more of this going to happen, you know, and just, I think people see that there's cash flow out there. And I think as long as there's commissions that are willing to put on these fights, I mean, look, you know, it's these guys, you know, fighters going to be able to make a ton of money out there. And, you know, I did like Dana White's response saying, yeah, you know, I'll counter his offer. You fight Amanda Nunes. I'm guessing his answer would be no on that one as well. And by the way, what other thing I'll mention, Dana White's classic response last week on Friday, I want to say it was John Morgan of MMA Junkie, asked him about his thoughts on the antitrust lawsuit getting class certification. Huge moment in that lawsuit last week. And Dana White goes, no, man, I don't know anything about it. Bullshit, Dana White. There is no way you did not know about that lawsuit getting class certification. You know, I don't cuss on this podcast too much, Daniel. That is bullshit. There is no way Dana White did not know that. Bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. We got to call it when we see it, man. I mean, I think that's the most frustrating thing about the current world we live in is whenever guys are just BSing, right? Whenever it's so clear, like one of the trends of the past 5 to 10 years has just been people in prominent roles completely lying to our face when we know it's BS. And that is absolutely something that was on his radar. If someone's putting you in court, you better know about it. You can't be a deadbeat dad and not pay that child support. You got to pay attention when you get those court orders or developments with your court cases. And certainly you are right to call Al out. That's a bunch of malarkey that he didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, I would be absolutely floored. Dana White did not know what happened. Be floored. I would imagine right when that judge classified that antitrust lawsuit, he was already on a call with the attorneys.
Absolutely. That's one of those situations you just know about what happens when it happens as it happens.
Yeah, man. It's that's I'm telling you that is so. And look, I would tell people if you want information on that lawsuit, the best people to follow, Paul Giff, John Nash, and Jason Cruz. Those three guys have been on that since day one. And I think I saw the other day they're talking about potentially that lawsuit could not be finished till the end of this decade.
Damn. That's crazy. It'll be interesting to follow those developments. And again, you are right to recommend those individuals because they know what they're talking about. They've been covering that beat for a long, long time. And they are just the best way to kind of understand what's transpiring. But it's going to be a long battle.
I just try to read up and try to, like, sometimes I want to go, can I get the Law for Dummies version of this? Because some of the stuff I just don't understand.
Oh, I know. It is complex and difficult. And it's obtuse for sure to understand.
So that is going to do it for this edition of the MMA Report podcast. Do thank everyone who checks out this podcast each and every episode. Also, mad kudos to the people checking out our sponsors. Got a nice email from the people over at HelloFresh yesterday. You're going to hear them later on. They got another deal coming for the MMA Report podcast. Listener, come up here at the end of the month. As always, check out all of our sponsors that we do have here at the MMA Report podcast. Of course, do myself a favor. A great way to show your support for this podcast. It doesn't cost you anything. 5-star review, Apple Podcasts. And, you know, leave a rating, review. It really does help us out and grow this podcast as well. So appreciate everyone who listens every week here on the MMA Report podcast. Of course, that is going to do it for this edition of the MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday and Sunday on your favorite podcasting platform.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer quick fix on Radio Influence.
This week on Sitting Ringside, we will talk to Impact Knockouts champion, the virtuosa Deonna Purrazzo. We'll talk to her about her big debut in Impact Wrestling, winning the Knockouts Championship from Jordan Grace on her first pay-per-view Slammiversary and all the buzz that went around that. Also, how she discovered professional wrestling, how she got involved in the business, and what was her big break. Also, we'll talk to when she came in to TNA for her eighth match. Her eighth match was in TNA Wrestling, also part of the rebirth of Women of Honor, her stardom experiences in Japan, and any AEW talent she might want to work with if given the opportunity based on current stories. Great chat with a great talent, the virtuosa Deanna Purrazzo, this week on Sitting Ringside.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.